Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. I'm Becca Bartleson.
I'm Brian Smith.
Coming up on this morning's news, Coretta Scott King, widow of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., has died. Today is retiring chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan's last day of work to celebrate Greenspan raised interest rates. And the IAEA today presented Iran with documents provided by the U.S. suggesting that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Portland area weather today, rain, heavy at times, strong winds, especially along the coast. Temperatures in the mid to upper 40s. Tonight, rain in the evening, then showers after midnight, lows in the 40s.
Coretta Scott King died. She was 78 years old. Flags at the King Center were lowered to half-staff this morning. Coretta Scott King turned a life shattered by her husband's assassination into one devoted to enshrining his legacy of human rights and equality. The King family said in a statement that she died overnight, but did not say where she died. She suffered a serious stroke and heart attack back in 2005. The poet Maya Angelou said on ABC's Good Morning America, "It's a bleak morning for me and for many peoples. And yet it's a great morning because we have a chance to look at her and see what she did and who she was." She was a supportive lieutenant to her husband, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., during the most tumultuous days of the American Civil Rights Movement. She had married him in 1953. After her husband's assassination in Memphis, Coretta Scott King kept his dream alive while also raising her four children. King's death was a monumental loss to the nation and the world at large, the Reverend Al Sharpton said in a written statement. She worked to keep his ideology of equality for all people at the forefront of the nation's agenda. She goaded and pulled for more than a decade to have her husband's birthday observed as a national holiday, then watched with pride in 1983 as President Reagan signed the bill into law. The first federal holiday was celebrated in 1986. King became a symbol in her own right of her husband's struggle for peace and brotherhood.
A disciple of the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was sentenced to 5 years probation for conspiring to kill a U.S. attorney more than 20 years ago. Catherine Stork, 60, cried in the federal courthouse Monday as she expressed remorse for her part in the aborted plot to kill the then U.S. attorney Charles Turner. Stork pleaded guilty last fall, joining six other followers who had earlier done the same, but the others were sentenced to prison for 2 to 5 years. Stork was a member of a commune that operated on a 100-square-mile ranch in the central Oregon town of Antelope from 1981 to 1985. The commune members plotted to take over the local county government in 1984, spiking salad bars in the Dalles with salmonella in an effort to incapacitate non-Rajneeshi voters. A year later, the Bhagwan's inner circle conspired to kill Turner after he was appointed to head a federal grand jury investigation of the commune. Stork and six other disciples were indicted in 1990, but Stork refused to leave Germany, where she is a naturalized citizen. In 1991, Germany declined an extradition request from the United States.
Two men accused of playing a role in arson attributed to the radical environmental movement have pleaded not guilty in a Eugene federal court. Stanislaus Meyerhoff and Kevin Tubbs and nine other defendants are scheduled for trial on October 31st. All are accused of taking part in acts of eco-sabotage over a five-year period. Court documents show timber company offices, a sports utility vehicle dealer, government research and wildlife facilities, a power line, a tree farm, two ranger stations, a ski resort, and a horse meat packing plant were their alleged targets.
Senator Hillary Clinton came to town last Friday. She met with both an adoring crowd and a storm of protest. KBOO's Anthony Seaton was there and has this report.
Hillary Rodham Clinton came to Portland last Friday asking for money. She's officially running for re-election as the junior senator from New York. However, some say it was an early start to her 2008 campaign for president. The rally at the downtown Hilton was sponsored by the Friends of Hillary Committee. The visit was also coordinated through the office of Portland City Commissioner Eric Stent. U.S. Representatives Darlene Hooley and Earl Blumenauer and Oregon Governor Ted Kulongoski all spoke, but all the money raised went to Hillary's war chest. Under current campaign law, any money collected by Hillary now as part of her 2006 campaign won't count against any limits in her 2008 presidential campaign. People paid $100 to attend the speech or $1,000 for a special meet and greet with Hillary herself. The attendees generally spoke in favor of Hillary before the speeches.
She is a great politician. She's moving to the center, which I think is very important for anyone who wants to go for the White House.
I think she's like many other members of Congress who have acquiesced to the imperial presidency. She's got her own agenda, and she's working it to the detriment of the United States of America.
And I want to hear from her why she's not saying she wants to pull out of Iraq, because, you know, I think she should. I think it's time.
However, there are protesters outside the Hilton. Will Seaman of the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition.
Senator Hillary Clinton has got it in her head that the way to become president of this country is to look more and more like George Bush. And we're here to remind her just how well that strategy worked for John Kerry. A disaster for his candidacy and a disaster for the country and the rest of the world. Now that's why we're out here. We're out here to convince Hillary Clinton and those folks who are wavering in our Oregon delegation to take a strong, vocal stand against this war, to call for bringing our troops home now.
During her speech, Code Pink protesters in the audience repeatedly tried to interrupt Hillary, but Hillary completely ignored them. The protesters were immediately arrested and dragged out of the hall. Beforehand, one of the Code Pink protesters said why they were there.
She's pro-war, from everything I can see. She's right of George Bush as far as Iran is concerned. And she voted for this war. She's done nothing to end it, even though the American people want this war over. And she's not listening to the people in this country. And if she's even thinking about running for president in 08, she's got to know that we are not going to support a pro-war candidate.
Later, Hillary gave her justification for supporting the war.
You're right. I am one of those people who has neither accepted the administration's position, which is we will stay as long as it takes, because I think that is an open invitation for us not to see the changes that we need in Iraq, for the Iraqis to take responsibility. But I am also not one of those who has said withdraw immediately, because if we take precipitous action, it could make a bad situation worse.
Despite arresting and ejecting over a dozen protesters, no charges were filed against them. And Hillary continued her roadshow on Saturday in San Francisco, where she faced more protest. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
In Portland, after months of wildlife studies and testimony from residents, environmentalists, recreationalists, and property owners, the Metro Council recently approved a still unfunded plan for the St. John's neighborhood. The city has decided to construct a nearly $8 million, almost 5-mile trail that will bring walkers and bikers for the first time into unspoiled portions of the 2,000-acre wetlands and shallow lakes. The trail will directly link to the St. John's neighborhood to Smith and Bybee Lakes by cutting north through Pier and Chimney Parks into the natural area, then branching off to the east to connect with the 40-mile loop trail that encircles the city. Supporters of alignment, one of four considered by Metro, said the design balances the desires of naturalists to protect the sensitive wildlife area and recreationalists who want access to the restful landscape. Opponents of the trail design say the location on the south side of the Columbia Slough and several hundred feet away from the Twin Lakes defeats its purpose, namely to put people close to the refuge. Other controversial parts of the plan involve constructing a costly new bridge across the Columbia Slough that would be anchored in the former landfill, cutting a paved path through sensitive wetlands south of the two lakes, and acquiring easements of right-of-ways through property currently in private or agency hands, this from the Oregonian.
Portland's progressive community lost a significant figure Monday with the death of Stu Albert, a former Yippie and cohort of the late Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. He died yesterday morning at age 66, surrounded by his wife Judy, his daughter Jessica, and many friends. Stu Albert was a peace activist, organizer, teacher, storyteller, and author. His books include Who the Hell is Stu Albert? And The 60s Papers, Documents of a Rebellious Decade, which he co-authored with his wife. In Portland, Stu was active in the Havurah Shalom Synagogue. He also participated in progressive Jewish groups and helped found the group Cousins, which fostered connections between local Jewish Americans and Arab Americans. He often worked together with his wife Judy, an administrator at Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette. KBOO talk show host Joe Uris was a longtime friend of Albert's. He says that Stu was a source of insight, history, and wisdom to many in the Portland community.
According to the BBC, the jury has been selected for the trial of former Enron bosses Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling, paving the way for a long-awaited court case to start. Eight women and four men from the Houston area were selected to make up the 12-person jury. The trial is set to start tomorrow and may last up to 4 months. Judge Lake told jurors it would be one of the most interesting and important cases ever tried, but he was not looking for people to exact revenge. After choosing the men and women, he told the jurors not to talk about the case during their trial duty or watch news reports and read about the case. Lay faces 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy relating to the firm's collapse in 2001, which followed a huge accounting scandal. Skilling faces 31 counts of fraud, conspiracy, insider trading, and lying to auditors about Enron's financial position. Both have denied all the charges. Lawyers for the defendants have called for the trial to be moved away from Houston. They are arguing that holding it in Enron's home city means their clients will not be able to get a fair hearing.
Samuel Anthony Alito is poised to take his place as the 110th Supreme Court Justice behind what is expected to be the most partisan victory for a high court nominee in modern history. Alito was to be confirmed Tuesday with the support of at least 57 senators in the GOP-controlled Senate who have stated their intention to back President Bush's selection to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The 55-year-old U.S. Appeals Court judge was then to be quickly sworn in before his expected appearance at Bush's annual State of the Union speech with the White House's other new Supreme Court judge, Chief Justice John Roberts. Alito and Roberts are expected to lead the 9-member Supreme Court into a new conservative era following the retirement of O'Connor. She was the court's first female justice and a key moderate swing vote on issues like assisted suicide, campaign finance law, the death penalty, affirmative action, and abortion. At most 6 or 7 Democrats will vote for Alito's confirmation, the lowest number of senators not in the president's party to support a Supreme Court nominee in modern history. By comparison, Justice Clarence Thomas was confirmed in 1991 with a 52-48 vote behind the support of 11 Democrats who broke party ranks and voted for President George H.W. Bush's nominee.
140 women from New Orleans arrived in Washington, D.C. yesterday. They are stay-at-home moms, successful professionals, and mothers of celebrities, and many of them are members of Louisiana's most prominent political families. They carried photographs of their flooded homes and called themselves Women of the Storm. They set out in small groups to invite each member of Congress to visit post-Katrina New Orleans to see the devastation firsthand and hopefully support a boost in federal aid to the region. The White House says $85 billion in federal assistance has been approved so far to help the region recover, including direct spending, tax breaks, and flood insurance. Some of that money is still in the pipeline, and many Gulf Coast officials say more will be needed. 5 months after the hurricane made landfall, 55 representatives and 30 senators have visited New Orleans. The women argue that delay in federal aid to New Orleans are the result of so few lawmakers seeing the destruction up close. The group is offering members of Congress 36-hour all-expense-paid trips to New Orleans.
A female ex-postal worker opened fire at a mail processing plant in Goleta, California, killing 6 people and critically wounding another before committing suicide last night. 2 wounded women were located inside and were taken to Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital. 1 died and the other was listed in critical condition early Tuesday with a gunshot wound to the head. Nearly 5 hours later, deputies found 4 additional bodies, including 1 believed to be the female shooter. The shooter, who was not identified, died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Last night's rampage sent dozens of employees running from the sprawling distribution center and prompted authorities to warn nearby residents to stay indoors.
A Mexican citizen was arrested on drug charges in the investigation into the longest tunnel ever found underneath the U.S.-Mexico border, U.S. officials said on Monday. The suspect was taken into custody Saturday by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. He appeared in federal court Monday on charges of conspiracy to import more than a ton of marijuana, which carries a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison. The 2,400-foot tunnel runs from a warehouse near the airport in Tijuana to a warehouse in San Diego. It was unclear how long it had been in operation, but more than 2 tons of marijuana were found inside. Authorities say the passage was 5 feet high and ran as deep as 90 feet below the surface. It had a concrete floor, lights along one of the hard soil walls, a groundwater pump, and pipes that circulated fresh air. The man under arrest, Carlos Cardenas Calvillo, worked at the U.S. warehouse, which had been leased for the stated purpose of distributing produce. Cardenas told investigators that he began working in sales at the warehouse in October. The Drug Enforcement Administration has said it suspects Tijuana Ruthless Arnaldo Felix Drug Syndicate, or another well-known cartel, was involved.
Republican Senator Sam Brownback, a potential presidential candidate, said yesterday he meant no offense to homosexuals when he used the word fruits in a recent interview with Rolling Stone magazine. In a lengthy profile titled God Senator, the magazine quotes the Kansas Republican as criticizing countries like Sweden that allow civil unions between same-sex couples. Brownback said, quoting a biblical passage from Matthew 7:19, "You'll know them by their fruits." Rolling Stone writer Jeff Charlotte said in the story that Brownback appeared to be calling gay Swedes fruits, a derogatory term for homosexuals. After gay and lesbian advocacy groups denounced the comments last week, Brownback issued a statement saying his quote was in no way referring to sexual orientation. His explanation was greeted with skepticism by the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay rights organization.
Iran has given the International Atomic Energy Agency sensitive documents that appear linked to nuclear warhead designs. The move is the latest attempt by Tehran to stave off being reported to the UN Security Council, diplomats said today. The documents contain 1.5 pages describing how to cast fissile uranium into hemispherical shape of warheads. At the same time, the UN agency presented Iran with intelligence provided by the United States that suggests Tehran has been working on nuclear weapons. Late last year, inspectors say saw the documents that apparently showed how to mold highly enriched grade uranium into the core of warheads, and it figured in a November report by the IAEA Chief Mohammed El-Baradei. Initial reports said the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency was given the documents at the time, but the diplomats said Friday that Tehran handed them over only last week in a show of cooperation meant to head off increasing international consensus on reporting Iran to the Security Council over suspicion that its nuclear activities might be a cover for developing nuclear weapons. Iran has claimed it did not ask for the document, but was given it anyways as part of another black market purchase.
The permanent 5 members of the UN Security Council agreed today that this week's meeting of the UN Nuclear Watchdog should report Iran to the Council over its nuclear programs, this according to Reuters. According to the foreign ministers of China, Russia, the United States, France, and Britain, as well as Germany and the European Union's foreign police chief, this week's extraordinary IAEA board meeting should report to the Security Council its decision on the steps required of Iran. A senior U.S. official said the statement meant Russia and China were on board with the United States and the European powers, that there must be strong action taken by the IAEA on Thursday or Friday against Iran to prevent Tehran from building a nuclear bomb. The statement said ministers agreed that the UN Security Council should await the IAEA Director General's report to a March IAEA meeting before deciding what further action to take. The Council could ultimately impose sanctions against Iran, but there are many steps before this could happen. The statement added that they should all continue their resolve to work for a diplomatic solution to Iran's nuclear weapons program.
According to the Bloomberg News Service, the U.S., European Union, United Nations, and Russia said Hamas officials must form a Palestinian government that accepts Israel's existence or risk a cutoff of international aid. The diplomatic group, known as the Quartet, threatened late yesterday in London to review all aid should Hamas maintain its violent opposition and refusal to endorse the peace efforts. The Quartet's statement set a deadline on demands that European leaders and President George W. Bush made after Hamas's surprise election victory. At stake is hundreds of millions of dollars to support the Palestinian administration and building projects. Europe is the biggest donor to the Palestinian Authority, spending 500 million euros, about $604 million, in 2005 on utilities, food aid, social services, and election support. Hamas has threatened to tap Iran, now battling the U.S., EU, and U.S. over its nuclear program, to replace any lost European money. A senior U.S. official said the Palestinian Authority needs about $100 million to function each month and relies mostly on donations. In jeopardy may also be a group of eight pledged in the July to help raise $9 billion over 3 years to help the Palestinians develop the Gaza Strip, which Israel evacuated in August. Officials said there would be no cut in aid to the current Palestinian government led by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas of the defeated Fatah Party.
Saddam Hussein and his entire defense team will boycott the former dictator's trial when it resumes tomorrow, according to The Guardian. Khalil al-Dulameh said the move was in protest at what he described as the bias of the latest lead judge appointed to the case. Yesterday's hearing was the most confrontational yet. Rauf Abdel-Rahman, in his first day presiding over the court, made it clear that he would not tolerate the outbursts and theatricalities that have previously characterized the case. The judge threw Saddam, his former vice president, and a defense lawyer out of the court, while their defense team left of their own accord. Mr. Abdel-Rahman, who said the trial would continue in their absence if necessary, then pushed ahead with hearing witnesses. Dulami said this comedy meant the judge was biased against his client. The court hearing yesterday lacked the basics of a fair and honest trial, and the judge was biased against the defendants, who, under the law, are innocent until proven guilty, he said as he arrived in Jordan from neighboring Iraq.
Al Jazeera Television aired a videotape from an Iraqi militant group yesterday showing U.S. hostage Jill Carroll. Al Jazeera said she appealed for her fellow Americans to press for the release of Iraqi women held by U.S.-led forces. Carroll was seen crying in the grainy footage that carried a January 28th date stamp and a logo showing the name of the Revenge Brigade militant group. The voice of the 28-year-old journalist kidnapped on January 7th was not heard. After the airing of the videotape, the Boston-based newspaper issued a fresh appeal for Carroll's release. The U.S. military freed five women prisoners last week, but U.S. and Iraqi officials said their release had been planned and not linked to Carroll's case. Al Jazeera aired a video showing Carroll on January 17th and said her abductors threatened to kill her if their demand was not met, but did not name the group that kidnapped her. There has been a spate of kidnapping of Westerners in Iraq over the past few months after a lull during most of 2005. Four Christian peace activists, a Briton, an American, and two Canadians, are still being held captive.
In Iraq, U.S. troops clashed throughout the day with insurgents west of Baghdad. Iraqi police launched a new raid in a Sunni Arab-dominated part of the capital, despite Sunni calls to halt such operations during talks to form a new government. The clashes west of Baghdad occurred in Ramadi, capital of the insurgent-ridden Anbar province, and began when gunmen fired at least five rocket-propelled grenade rounds and rifles at U.S. Army soldiers, a military spokesman said. U.S. troops later called in an airstrike against insurgents holed up at the Ramadi sports stadium, raising a column of smoke, residents said. Two civilians were injured when mortar shells exploded near the provincial office building, and one woman was killed by small arms fire. In Baghdad, Iraqi Interior Ministry commandos searched the notorious Dora neighborhood, a largely Sunni Arab district, and scene of frequent bombings and killings. More than 80 suspects were arrested, including 8 Sudanese, 4 Egyptians, a Tunisians, and Lebanese. The raid occurred despite calls of Sunni Arab politicians for a halt to such operations, as the country's Shiite Sunni Kurdish politicians are discussing formation of a new national unity government, which U.S. officials hope can win the trust of the Sunni Arab community, the backbone of the insurgency. Sunni Arabs have accused the Shiite-led Interior Ministry forces of abuses against Sunnis. Ministry officials insist the raids are necessary to combat insurgents. In the latest attacks, a suicide car bomber slammed into a commando headquarters where police were training in Nasiriyah, about 200 miles southeast of Baghdad, killing one policeman and wounding more than 30. Police reported this. A roadside blast in western Baghdad killed an Iraqi policeman and wounded another as well.
Al-Qaeda number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has appeared on videotape taunting the U.S. about an airstrike in Pakistan which failed to kill him. On the tape, aired by Al Jazeera TV, he called the U.S. president a butcher and asked, "Do you want to know where I am? I am among the Muslim masses." Pakistani officials said some Al-Qaeda militants died in the attack near the Afghan border earlier this month. However, most of the dead were villagers, and Pakistan condemned the strike. In the taped message, Zawahiri said the raid had targeted him and four of his companions. He said the whole world has discovered the magnitude of the United States' lies and failures and how barbaric in its fight against Islam and Muslims. He referred to the offer of a truce made by Osama bin Laden in January of 19th, tape also aired on Al Jazeera, saying the Al-Qaeda leader had offered the U.S. an honorable exit from Iraq. On Iraq and Afghanistan, he told Americans that Mr. Bush had given them a future painted in the color of blood. And he also noted British military involvement. This is the second appearance for the Al-Qaeda deputy leader this month and is regarded as Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. The two have evaded capture since U.S.-led forces brought down the Taliban regime in Afghanistan in 2001 following September 11th attacks on the U.S., this according to the BBC.
The World Social Forum ended in Venezuela, with President Hugo Chavez warning that to remain relevant, the annual gathering must take bolder steps, such as addressing the role of militaries in defending against U.S. imperialism. The Venezuelan leader dominated attention yesterday on the final day of the event as he spoke for hours to liberal activists and forum organizers. Chavez has accused President Bush of plotting to overthrow him to seize control of Venezuela's vast oil reserves. U.S. officials strongly deny that allegation, but have increasingly accused Chavez of accumulating power and threatening democracy. Chavez warned that a U.S. invasion of Venezuela would lead to a 100-year war, and that any U.S. attack on Iran, with which he has friendly relations, would be 10 times worse than Iraq. Chavez's speech marked the close of the 6-day forum, which organizers said drew more than 70,000 participants, a majority of them Venezuelans. The anti-globalization meeting is held each year to counter the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. This year is it being held in 3 countries, including a smaller gathering that ended last week in Mali and another 2 months from now in Pakistan. Chavez declared the Venezuelan event a huge success and said next year's will be held in Nairobi, Kenya. The forum drew fewer participants than in the past and suffered from organizational problems that saw many events canceled or moved. It also reaffirmed that Chavez is a powerful voice in the region for many.
And this has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Liam Delta is on the boards right now. Kathleen Stevenson is AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
And thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. and, or actually, coming up later this morning on KBOO. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. They'll discuss the Abramoff scandal and other examples of corruption. At 9 on Between the Covers, it's a special extended edition featuring award-winning journalist J.R. Moringer, author of memoir, The Tender Bar, about growing up at the local bar. At 9:45, Scott Forrester, host of Monday on the Environment, we'll be in for some environmental information. And we'll also have a movie review from Jay Thiemeyer. He reviews Down to the Bone, a film about recovery. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, the topic is Miracle Theater's Men on the Verge 2. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And thanks for listening, or be sure to join us this evening for KBOO News at 5 p.m. And remember to take a look at the KBOO website, all new, all better. And want to know what goes into the KBOO Morning News? If you have some of the guts to help make the sausage, volunteer in the AM newsroom and call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Thanks for listening.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for January 31st, 2006. Things are going to get noisy in Portland this afternoon. There will be people banging drums, pots and pans, singing, chanting, and yelling all throughout Portland come 6 p.m. World Can't Wait is organizing massive protests all across the country to coincide with the State of the Union address. They are calling it State of Emergency, and it is happening simultaneously in cities all across the United States. In Portland, there is a gathering at Pioneer Square starting at 4 p.m., including a local band called the Sand People. From there, marches will be led throughout Portland neighborhoods with the goal of drowning out Bush as he attempts to deliver his address. That's when things will get noisy. By 6 p.m., there will be Portlanders marching all over town in groups, bringing with them their voices and calling on their neighbors to come away from their television sets and join the march. There are other related community events being planned all throughout Portland. For details, contact World Can't Wait. Their email address is portland@worldcantwait.org. That's portland@worldcantwait, that's all one word, .org. Or call them at 206-666-BUSH. Once again, that's 666-2874. Call for details or arrangements. That is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, the 31st of January, 2006.